What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends podcast, and I'm Larry Rifkin, and with me is constitutional scholar John Krofcik. Hi, John.
I don't know about that.
Well, we'll find out. Alert! Constitutional scholarship will be on display in this episode of America Trends. So, John, well, if I call you a constitutional scholar...
I did kind of bad on the immigration test, so...
Yeah, but you really didn't dig deep into all of the amendments, and I know those are things you've got down pat.
Oh, yeah.
Full memorization. So, John, do you find the Constitution to be interesting, relevant, ignored, superseded? I mean, what do you think?
I think it's an amazing document. I really do. This country was really, we had some forward-thinking people to put such a document together, which puts the people in control, supposed to.
Well, I wonder, and we should ask Jen Briney, who's our good friend, and we've got to have her on again, from Congressional Dish, another great podcast that you need to go to, and whether she really hears politicians as they're debating a bill or as they're looking at ways that the government can get involved in our lives, how many of them really, seriously, can point to the constitutional fabric that either allows this or disallows the action they want to take, how much they really in the background have the Constitution in their mind.
Yeah, I don't think too much. I think we get back to with all the corruption. I don't think they're thinking about the Constitution. I think they're thinking about being reelected.
But they've got that American flag on their lapel, all of them. Yeah. Democrats, Republicans, socialists, they all have it, right? So what does that mean? Does that symbolize anything? Or is this just a device the Constitution used to win an argument?
I think when necessary, they can use the Constitution, right, as an argument. It's to win an argument, but I don't think it's at the forefront of their thought when they're making law.
Well, I don't know. Do they carry it in their front pocket or their back pocket? Do they get up on soapboxes and read it verbatim anymore like they do at Hyde Park? I don't know if you've ever gone to London, John.
I've never been to London, no.
Well, I got to tell you, at Hyde Park, I love it. Not that we don't have lots of ways that we can express ourselves, but you go to Hyde Park and right up on that soapbox and you hear people articulating the most radical, extreme, incredibly engaging views. Yeah. And people just get up there on the box.
That's funny. There was something going on in New Britain. They had
really?
People were getting up on this box and they had this megaphone and they were just... talking
oh,
about
right here in Connecticut, you're
Connecticut,
saying.
Yeah.
So they were modeling what goes on in London.
It was pretty amazing.
I do love that. I really do. And, you know, again, if we went out with a microphone and said to people, hey, do you have a favorite article or amendment? I mean, do you think people, what would they look at us and say, what? Article of clothing? What are you talking about here? I mean, the First Amendment, I think a lot of people would certainly refer to, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think... But I think as you go down, even I couldn't, some of the amendments, I don't think I would remember.
But you're not the type of person like Judge Roy Moore, who says after the first 10, we don't need, you know, the ones that unenslave people, we don't need those. Excuse me, Judge. I wonder what he's doing. Oh, he's riding around on his horse right now. But, you know, when you look at it, John, you and I have learned enough about the Constitution in our recent tapings. And we did an incredible one with, of course, a great scholar of the First Amendment. And that is still posted, and you can see that.
Definitely the go soul, back and listen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one. But we do know from Floyd Abrams that, in fact, these amendments were not put in any order of importance. And there are a lot of people who want to fool you about that. They want to say, well, the Second Amendment, that's really important because they put it second.
Yeah.
But I think they draw it out of a hat or they did something. I don't know how, but it was not because of importance.
Right,
that was something you and I learned. I mean, today we go to the Second Amendment. That's number two on the charts with a bullet, literally, John. And since it's been in the news as to whether we should put more limits on it or whether we can legally do that, there are some people who say...
Well, I mean, it is kind of vague. I will give you that. It is kind of vague. So, but I think it's been interpreted that, you know, it's okay for us to do it as long as we obey the law, really. I mean,
but the states are given a lot of freedom,
right,
as they want to restrict various uses. And don't forget, I think you and I also had a guest on about the old days when you had all these gangsters running around with Tommy guns, and they were much more impactful and forceful than the police force meant to protect the public.
But
they outlawed those weapons.
Well, and I think that's a good idea, and I think we need to look at that. But the problem, as I see it, is not with the law-abiding citizen. It's with the amount of guns we got floating around that are illegal. And how do we get a grasp on that? I mean,
or is it too late, unfortunately?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that we haven't addressed. We want to put so much limits on the people who have guns legally, and I think that's a problem. And I don't think people need automatic weapons, or they don't need bazookas.
Well, semi-automatics that now can be adapted to be automatics.
Automatic weapons. Who hunts with an automatic weapon of any type, you know, really? So I think we do need restrictions, but I really think we got to have a conversation about not the law-abiding citizen, about the people who are illegal. How are we going to stop?
But you know,
these
one of the problems, though, that we have. I agree with you generally, but one of the problems we have is a lot of the folks who have done some pretty heinous things lately are law-abiding until they're not, and they've been collecting this cache of weaponry. Look at that guy in Vegas.
Right,
there was
right.
just no indication that he was on the verge of doing what is the worst massacre in American history. There was just no indication.
No, you're right. And then there was that other one where the guy, somehow he slipped through the cracks, I remember, because of, I think the military, you know, he was a wife beater or whatever. And
recently.
And that was never put on his record. So, I mean, there are problems. I mean, you know, I don't know if you can stop even, you know, somebody like the guy in Vegas from, I mean, maybe a red flag should have gone off with the amount of guns he had. You know, I mean, he's going to the store and buying them. Somebody's keeping a list. You know, maybe there should have been some alarms going off there. But
well, you know, I think what's important is that we don't give up on this issue, and that we don't just throw up our hands and say, well, you know, it is the way it is. Because there are many countries that do a whole lot better as it relates to gun violence than the United States. And at least we're having a conversation about
right.
it. And we're bringing into this conversation today a gentleman who calls himself, John, an originalist when it comes to the Constitution. Now, that means that there's some literal translation of the Constitution. And I'm not certain that I'm an originalist. In fact, I'm not, because I just think there are too many things that are left open to interpretation. I think there are too many circumstances that have gone from one century to another. How does the Constitution talk about net neutrality on the internet?
I
don't know. And so I'm less an originalist, but Ilan Werman is joining us. And he's written a book about the Constitution that I find quite interesting. And I think he's a very thoughtful guy. I think he's very reasonable in his approach to all of this. And he even talks about the Second Amendment and the fact that there is some room for lawmakers to go ahead and put some limits and restrictions. And so we're going to delve into the Constitution, the way he interprets it, the original recipe, like KFC, right? The kernel of the Constitution. And then we're going to talk about the Second Amendment in particular. So this is really, really interesting.
Very interesting.
It is. So Ilan Werman joining us right now on America Trends. With us is Ilan Werman, and he's written a book called A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism. Well, for those who don't understand anything about originalism, Ilan, you've got your work cut out on America Trends podcast. Explain the concept.
Sure. So originalism is the idea that we should interpret the Constitution with its original meaning, with the meaning the words would have had to the framers who wrote the Constitution and to the public that ratified the Constitution. But I think more fundamentally, originalism sort of stands for this idea that there's a distinction between what the law is and what the law ought to be, and that this is in fact how we look at all law, whether it's a law enacted by Congress in the 1790s or the Defense of Marriage Act in the 1990s, we first ask, what does this law actually say? What does it mean? What does it do? And only then do we ask whether it still ought to be the law. So originalism stands for this proposition that this framework for looking at all law applies to the Constitution itself, which is also a law. We first have to figure out what it says, what it does, what legal effect it has in the world, what kind of constitutional regime it created. And only then we have to ask, and we do have to ask, whether the Constitution is a good Constitution, whether it still ought to be the law. And so originalism, most of the discussion is focused on sort of that first question. How do you interpret it? Well, you know, the originalist position is that you interpret the words the same way you'd interpret any public instruction. So it could be a fried chicken recipe that you find in your attic. It happens to be dated from 1789 and written in Philadelphia. How would you interpret it? Well, you'd interpret its words with the meaning those words would have had to the chefs and the audience to whom it was directed as a public instruction.
So but Ilan, for many who are listening, they're going to say, wait a minute, I've read the writings of Madison and Jefferson and others, and they didn't even agree exactly what those words meant. So how are we to give it an original cast when, in fact, the originators might disagree among themselves?
So that's absolutely right, and there is no denying the existence of indeterminacies or ambiguities or vagueness, right? So the Constitution, or let's go back to the analogy to a fried chicken recipe, which is an analogy I discuss in the book, and it's not original to me. Gary Lawson drew this very entertaining analogy in a Law Review article in which he basically compared interpreting a Constitution to interpreting a recipe for fried chicken. But the recipe could say something like, add pepper to taste. Well, what does that mean? Whose taste? And that's kind of broad. It's kind of vague. And there could be disagreement exactly on what it means. So it's entirely possible, indeed highly likely, that trying to faithfully follow that recipe will lead to a range of plausible fried chickens. When chefs actually try to make it, you know, people try to actually make the fried chicken, you could have a variation in what actually results. And I think the same thing is true of originalism. Of course, the founders didn't agree, but we don't agree today on the meaning of statutes and words used in statutes. So the existence of indeterminacy and ambiguity is a problem that all interpreters have to confront. But it doesn't, I think, undermine the fundamental exercise, which is that we're trying to figure out the original public meaning of the words.
And yet, when we look at the Constitution, they recognize that perhaps that we would need to amend it over time, and they gave us avenues in which to do that. And we've done it, I believe, 27 times. So how can we look at it and say that this document is something we need to follow to the letter?
Well, so the same thing can be asked about the amendments, right? We pass an amendment like the 27th Amendment or the 20th Amendment. Why do we need to follow those to the letter? Why do we need to follow a law passed by Congress to the letter? So nothing is given, right? Mm-hmm. I suppose we don't have to do anything. We don't have to interpret it with its original public meaning. We could have a legal system that doesn't give legal effect to the original public meaning of the words. We could have a legal system in which the words are just sort of guideposts for judges to exercise discretion and to make fair judgments in the cases before them. But I would submit that there's a reason that we don't ordinarily interpret laws that way. And for that same reason, we don't interpret the Constitution that way. We are a government of laws and not of men. And part of this concept of the rule of law is that we should be governed by sort of predictable, stable rules that the people themselves in a free society should be able to understand and read for themselves. Now, of course, we're going to rely on lawyers and things like that, but we're talking about an ideal here. In a free society, we the people should be able to consult the laws, consult the Constitution, and understand what our obligations are and understand what our officials' obligations are. And so I think that question could be posed of all laws, not just the law of the Constitution. And it's not obvious, it's not self-evident, but I think the answer boils down to this concept of being a government of laws and not of men.
Well, how could Ruth Bader Ginsburg be on the same court as Antonin Scalia, and both have validity, yet they have a very different view, they did, of what it was that they were interpreting?
Oh, and they were great friends.
I know.
So there are, I guess, two things one could say on this. The first is, let's put Justice Ginsburg aside for the moment, and let's talk about Elena Kagan. Elena Kagan says, we're all textualists now. And she credits Justice Scalia for that. But even Justice Kagan and Justice Scalia would disagree when they're actually trying to implement the original public meaning, or actually trying to discern the original public meaning. So there could still be room for disagreement. That's just a fact of life. People are going to interpret words differently. They're going to interpret text differently. But, you know, if judges are just allowed to impose sort of their freewheeling moral philosophies or political philosophies, they're also going to disagree about that, right? You're not going to find any method that's error-free or disagreement-free.
Well, do you find it to be rather disheartening, as I do, that whenever now we are nominating somebody for the Supreme Court, already we give them a political cast and we say, oh, they're always going to go with the president who put them in. So this is now 5-4, that they aren't going to look at the Constitution and various issues very differently, regardless of who appointed them. Are they also predictable today? And are they then not political actors?
Yes, so it is somewhat disappointing. Having said that, most of the Supreme Court cases are unanimous. You know, they're pure questions of statutory construction, or they don't have a political valence. The same thing is true of the lower courts. Generally, it's 3-0 decisions in the circuit courts of appeal. But they're in the hot button politically controversial cases. Yes, it is disappointing that we expect more and more 5-4 decisions. Or look at the Fourth Circuit's en banc, the travel ban case. It was 10 Democratic appointees on the one hand and 3 Republican appointees in dissent. So it is disappointing that we come to expect this of judges. But part of it, I think there are two causes here. Part of it is sort of the legal realist insight that, and I'm going to exaggerate that insight right now, that judges often can decide cases based on what they had for breakfast. Okay, that's a caricature of the legal realist insight, but there's some truth to it, that judges are creatures of their predispositions and prior commitments and life experiences, and that even if they try to do things objectively, politics and other sociological or psychological backgrounds will always sort of bleed into their decisions. But the other thing is, the court has, in a sense, made itself political. Now, maybe that's inevitable, but more and more people look at the Supreme Court and say, hey, my goodness, why is it that they're deciding the gay marriage question? Isn't that an issue for democratic self-government and so on? Now, right or wrong, right? Let's put that aside. But the point is, the court is perceived as political and having assumed responsibility over many political questions. And if that's true, then shouldn't we expect that they would vote based on their political predispositions?
Well, for example, I know that we've left a lot of things out of our Constitution and said these aren't issues for the principles of the country to be focused on. These are things for politicians to be accountable for. And let me give you an example. Debt in the United States, which is running rampant, we know. And there's a group called Convention of States, and we had one of the representatives on our podcast, and they want to have a balanced budget amendment. Is that even a legitimate exercise in terms of what it is that should be in the Constitution or that should be left out of the Constitution and allowed people who are our political leaders to fight over that? How do we even know that that which is in the Constitution is what the original intent was for the jurists to deal with or the Constitution to set aside and for the politicians to deal with on an everyday contemporary basis? We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
though.
Message us
news.
At Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
So one of the great geniuses, in fact, I think you've highlighted it, one of the great geniuses of the Constitution is that it doesn't actually require very much. The list of rights. So it sets up a government. It sets up a frame of government, you know, the separation of powers and checks and balances, the modes of election. But it doesn't actually require the government to do very much. And the rights that it protects, it doesn't prevent the government from doing too much. It protects crucial rights, the rights most essential for the success of a free society. But almost everything else, on political issues, moral issues, social, cultural, economic issues, the founders left so much for the democratic process precisely because they knew we would evolve and progress over time, and they didn't want to put things in stone in the Constitution. And I think that's a virtue. That's a virtue. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, right, because the founders assumed a certain amount of capacity in mankind for self-government. That's the whole essence of this experiment. But on the other hand, they also knew that through exercise of self-government, mankind can tyrannize one another. Majorities often tyrannize minorities. And we sometimes won't be very good at the self-government thing. And the debt and not balancing the budget might be an example of our, in some respects, a lack of capacity for self-government. I don't think it proves we're incapable of self-government. But certainly it could be one of those examples. Now, to answer your question more directly, though, there's always a risk of putting something like the balanced budget amendment in the Constitution because, again, it's a virtue that the Constitution says so little things so that they can says so few things so that we, the people, through the democratic process, can accommodate to changing circumstances. The balanced budget amendment might sound right and good right now, but what happens if we balance the budget and then a war, God forbid, of some kind breaks out? Would the courts have to insert sort of an implied exception? But what if they don't? I mean, it's always risky putting things in the fundamental charter of government. And certainly if we can't balance the budget today, through majority votes in the U.S. Congress, I really don't see how we're going to get the amendment passed anyway. But that's an issue for another day.
Yeah, absolutely. What if somebody's listening to this and they say, well, how could the founders have really understood what 21st century America is about and all the technology and all the changes and the genetic advances and so forth? I mean, how do you respond to that?
So the founders couldn't possibly know about any of those circumstances, but the Constitution they wrote didn't require them to know what the future would look like because the founders understood human nature. And they, I think, understood the fundamental requirements of a free government. They had to create a constitution, on the one hand, that enabled self-government, that enabled us to rule ourselves, but on the other hand, that protected a large measure of natural liberties. And those purposes, I think, are still the purposes of a free government, of a free constitution. And so the founders in the Constitution, I think, accomplished that essential, but in a sense, bare-bones mission, that bare bones objective of balancing these two competing ends of government. And I think those ends and objectives still apply today. I'll say one other thing. The founders, when they wrote things like the First Amendment, right, guaranteeing the freedom of speech, or the Fourth Amendment, guaranteeing that we are free of unreasonable searches and seizures, from an originalist perspective, that doesn't mean that the First Amendment doesn't apply to the internet. Of course the First Amendment applies to the internet. They wrote a standard, and that standard and its meaning gets applied to future circumstances, including future technological circumstances. So the Fourth Amendment applies for if a police officer puts a GPS device on your car, two things that the founders could never have envisioned. The Fourth Amendment applies because they didn't say, you have a right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures in all your papers, things, houses, effects, as they exist in 1789. It didn't say free of unreasonable searches and seizures of your horse-drawn carriages, right? It just put the standard, and the standard can adapt to future circumstances. So I think the founders, what they wrote was actually remarkably enduring.
Well, you also suggest that it can also work with three different philosophies, libertarian, progressives, and conservatives, that actually, you know, you can look at this document and each can find their way to, in your mind, maintaining the intent of the originalists.
That's right. And that raises, you know, an interesting question. If progressives can claim to be originalists and conservatives can claim to be originalists and libertarians can claim to be originalists, is originalism too capacious to be really valuable? You know, if it doesn't give more concrete answers but allows such a broad range of plausible answers, is it really worth anything? So the first thing I would say is I think originalism allows progressive results politically speaking, and it allows libertarian results politically speaking, and it allows conservative results politically speaking, because, again, they left so much, the Constitution left so much for the democratic process. So I constantly hear conservatives make arguments that the Constitution requires certain conservative policies. Libertarians, you know, as much as I consider myself, you know, at least half libertarian, they tend to do this a lot. They always somehow seem to argue that the Constitution requires, as a constitutional matter, a libertarian kind of result. And I think political liberals, for their part, do it too. I think most of them aren't originalist. They're what you'd call living constitutionalists. But a lot of people try to make the Constitution require what they prefer politically, whether it's conservatives, libertarians, or progressives. I think our Constitution allows all of these options to play out in the battlefield of democracy, so to speak. And so in that sense, originalism is, I think, very compatible with all these different political viewpoints. Now, if you interpret the Constitution as an originalist, will you end up with progressive interpretations or conservative interpretations or libertarian interpretations? I think the answer is sometimes you'll get answers in each camp, but those will have to be assessed on sort of a case-by-case basis. And we just have to be wary of people with political preferences and political predispositions trying to make the Constitution require their own preference.
And yet I know that you have great devotion to Antonin Scalia, and people would consider him, he considered himself an originalist, to be a very conservative jurist.
That's right. That's right. And there may have been cases where his conservatism arguably led him to certain results in the same way that liberals sometimes use the Constitution to lead to liberal results. And there's no doubt about that. And the best thing we can hope for is that all sides try to do this inquiry as honestly and diligently and rigorously as possible. But we have to be aware of our prior commitments, whether it's politically, intellectually, philosophically, or whatever, because they will spill over, and you have to be as careful as possible to account for those. But it's hard. It's very hard for judges to do that.
I do want to go into some of the debate that we're having today about the Second Amendment and get an originalist view of that. But I want to ask you, the book itself, A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism, our guest is Ilan Werman. What does A Debt Against the Living tell us? Again, it's Madisonian, but tell us, the origins of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas Jefferson wrote this very famous letter to James Madison in which he said the earth belongs to the living. The earth belongs to the living and not to the dead. The dead have neither power nor rights over it. And today, Jefferson's letter is often taken for the proposition that we shouldn't be bound by the dead hand of the past, and sort of an expression that's used in the law review lingo, that the Constitution should instead be a living, breathing document. But it turns out that Madison replied back to Jefferson. So Jefferson wrote, the earth belongs to the living in this letter to Madison.
Was it an email that he sent?
It was in that time.
Or a tweet.
Email, using, I guess, quills. Madison responded. Madison responded, and he said to Jefferson, if the earth be the gift of nature to the living, then their title can extend to the earth in its natural state only. In other words, the earth does belong to the living, but only in its natural condition. Then Madison went on to say, the improvements made by the dead form a debt against the living who take the benefit of them. This debt cannot be otherwise discharged, he said, than by a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvement. In other words, the Constitution is an improvement of such magnitude and such importance upon the natural condition of the world that posterity, it forms a debt against future generations who benefit from that improvement. And so my question is, in the book, who's right? Thomas Jefferson or James Madison? Does the Constitution create this debt against future generations? And if so, how do we faithfully discharge that debt? Madison implies a kind of originalism. So that's where it comes from. That's the set piece for the book.
All right. Now, let's go to the Second Amendment. Now, like a lot of what was written ultimately in the Constitution or its 10 amendments known as the Bill of Rights, there are several versions of the text of the Second Amendment, which has to make it a little bit more complicated for an originalist like yourself, different capitalization or punctuation. And this one has always gotten people's attention because we want to know whether, in fact, these are two separate thoughts or one integrated thought. And let me read it. And this is the one ratified by the states and authenticated by Thomas Jefferson, the Secretary of State. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So help us with this.
So what I can do, I'll do two things. One is, let's talk about the D.C. v. Heller decision where the court, it was close, it was 5-4, how they sort of parsed this. And the conclusion of the court was that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state is what they call the prefatory clause. It's stating a purpose. And then you get the operative clause. How are you going to effectuate that purpose? What's the actual rule? What's the injunction? And that says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So what the majority of the court said was that, yes, there was this purpose, this underlying purpose of protecting against government tyranny, the requirement for having a militia in order to do so. But now that we've stated that purpose, how are we going to guarantee that by ensuring that the people have the right to keep and bear arms? And so they say that's the rule, that's the injunction. Now, this is often misconstrued today, right? It doesn't mean that it only applies to muskets, right? That's like what we talked about. The First Amendment applies to the internet. The Fourth Amendment applies to GPS and cars. The Second Amendment doesn't just apply to muskets. It applies to modern arms. But you can have reasonable regulations, right? The question, of course, is how do you draw the line? Bazookas and tanks might fall on one side of them. Even automatic weapons may fall on one side of them. I think, you know, they're pretty much illegal. Just sidearms, pistols for self-defense might fall on the other. You know, we're semi-automatics. I don't necessarily know where that comes from.
Yeah.
What side of the line that falls?
Well, it's interesting. When the police and those who are there to protect, the citizenry say that we are outmanned and outgunned, and you get back to the machine guns in the old days of Machine Gun Kelly and all, that was the impetus to outlaw, I believe, a lot of these machine guns and these automatic weapons.
That's right, and it could be perfectly reasonable to do that. And I think, in fact, we do that. I don't know if that would extend to semi-automatic weapons. I mean, I'm not a policy expert on gun control. That's for sure. So I couldn't give you the policy arguments for or against. But I will say that the court is afraid to take up new Second Amendment cases precisely because it's so hard to draw the line. You know, do you draw it at semi-automatic or not, and so on. And so I don't think the court, they've denied certiorari in a bunch of cases, Second Amendment cases, and I don't think they're going to take it up. I will say one other thing, if you don't mind my backtracking
sure.
a bit, about the purpose for the Second Amendment. And this is, I think, what the political liberals often, what bothers them about this, is that they see the purpose as being to protect against government tyranny, which conservatives say, right? That's what they avow. That's what they say. And they just think that's incredible today. They think it's crazy. They think it's crazy that we should be afraid of government tyranny. And it does, in some respect, sound a bit crazy. I think the risk of government tyranny today is quite far off, even with President Trump at the helm, you know, and certainly when President Obama was at the helm, it seemed crazy. But I would just like to put that in perspective. The Constitution was meant to endure for, in a sense, centuries and centuries, if not all time. And when we look at all of recorded human history, right, the 3,000 years of recorded human history, it's been a history of misery, war, violence at the hands of not just state actors, but against one another, right, at the hands of mobs. Just in the last century, Europe, Western Europe, enlightened Western Europe, saw a Holocaust, witnessed a Holocaust. And bringing it back home, just 50 years ago, mm-hmm. an entire population of Americans was subjugated in the Jim Crow South. What's the first right the segregation laws took away from Black Americans? They took away their right to own guns, because in a free society, guns are or weapons are how people ensure their natural rights of self-preservation, and that's the first right that they take away from subjugated populations. So it may seem crazy today. It may seem crazy today that there's this risk of government tyranny. But for 3,000 years, we've been at risk not only of violence at the hand of government or at the hands of police or at the hands of mobs. And although in the last 20, 30, 40 years, we may seem to be so much more enlightened than 3,000 years of mankind has been, it may be true, but I think 40 years compared to 3,000 years should give us some pause and really make us think
whether
we will always be free of that risk.
Who's a conservative columnist, moved over from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times, and he had an editorial or an op-ed piece that really got people's attention, repeal the Second Amendment. And let me just quote, from a national security standpoint, the amendment's suggestion that a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state is quaint. The Minutemen that will deter Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un are based in missile silos in Minot, North Dakota, not farmhouses in Lexington, Massachusetts. So how much does the technology affect the thinking about the use of a sidearm?
I don't think the technology changes human nature. We had modern weapons in the 1960s, and an entire population of Americans, again, Black Americans, were subjugated in the Jim Crow South. If you were a Muslim after 9/11, you were the target of potential hate crimes, of Islamophobia. Their mosques were burned down, And I'm not saying that, you know, you have a right to pull the trigger anytime someone harms your property or destroys your property or even threatens you. But if your life is threatened in a free society, individuals are the most fundamental sovereign unit, and we have a right of self-preservation. We have a right of self-preservation, and that doesn't change. It may be hard to effectuate that right if the government has tanks and we don't. And in that sense, maybe the Second Amendment isn't as effective as it used to be. But does that make it unnecessary? I'm not so sure.
Well, let me ask you, a well-regulated militia, when you look at that term, that was the way we didn't have a standing army at that time. So we were looking for this well-regulated militia. So that assumes some state involvement, well-regulated, would really be fighting an outside foe. Or is this really meant for the internal concerns of a government overreach that even a constitution that really allows for self-governance could not protect us against?
I think it's both. The militia was, it's actually in the Constitution, it says that the federal government can call forth the militia only to suppress insurrection or repel invasion. It could not be used as an offensive force. So certainly you would need an army or a navy to do the offensive sort of war fighting. The militia wasn't enough for that. But I do think the founders thought that the militias would be a security at least against the federal government, but also I think at the state level, they thought an armed citizenry was also a good check. I will also say that at the time, I don't think the federal government had any sort of enumerated power to actually take individual arms away from people. And so I think in that sense, it might be why they were just protecting this right vis-a-vis the states and the militias in that sense. But that doesn't mean that the individual right to bear arms is considered any less fundamental a part of being a free society.
Do you think that the order in which the Bill of Rights, went down from 1 to 10, whether in fact that showed priority or no as an originalist?
I think not. So the First Amendment actually wasn't the First Amendment. It was the Third Amendment. The first two amendments did not garner sufficient votes, and so they didn't actually become a part of the Constitution, except I think one of them later became the 27th Amendment. There's an interesting question on whether that was actually properly ratified, but that's a discussion for another day. So I don't think there's a particular rhyme or reason to the order.
So as we look at the Second Amendment, we're suggesting here, as an originalist, that there are limitations that are reasonable for the government to put on. They have, and they've not
Absolutely.
Been challenged about a machine gun, or maybe if it were gun loopholes, or whether it was looking
Absolutely.
At some of the technology today, like these bump stocks, that going forward, those kinds of things can be determined by the society as being, out of bounds, and that would not fall against the original intent of the Constitution.
I think that's right. You know, background checks, preventing the mentally ill from having guns, and even preventing ordinary citizens from having automatic weapons, for sure, even bump stocks. If it makes a semi-automatic into that thing which is already recognized to be illegal, namely automatic weapons, I don't see why there would be a constitutional problem with that. But there will be hard line-drawing problems. There's no doubt about that, and it's why the Supreme Court is afraid to take another case.
Well, Ilan Werman, A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism, I thank you for sharing these really interesting concepts with us today and then entering into something that is going to be part of our future conversations in America, particularly about the Second Amendment of the Constitution. Thanks again for coming on America Trends Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of America Trends.